Hi, and welcome to the second episode of Behind the Masthead, a special series of the Behind the Evidence podcast supported by the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. My name is Casey Calver, and I'm editorial director at the Graykin Center. In this series, I'm talking with addiction journal editors, data scientists, and other scholars about the most pressing challenges to addiction research and publishing in the U.S. amid recent federal funding cuts and priority changes. In this second episode, I spoke with Dr. Tom Babor, who is a distinguished researcher in our field and editor emeritus of the Journal of Studies on Alcohol and Drugs. Throughout 2025, Tom has been extremely active with an organization called the Addiction Science Defense Network, and he is the lead author of the Clarion Call editorial, signed by 29 addiction journal editors from 12 countries, which has now been republished in a number of addiction journals. You know, what I enjoyed the most about my conversation with Tom was the fact that he has turned his profound concern for the preservation of addiction science and research into action that's making a material impact. In the interview, Tom says, quote, "Science is a form of free press. We say what we want, and we have strict rules that tell our constituents to adhere to the truth. If we can preserve that, we have a powerful weapon." I hope that our listeners here take some inspiration from that message. So check the show notes for links to the Addiction Science Defense Network, the Clarion Call editorial, and to learn more about the Graykin Center and our publications. Please also consider leaving a review of this podcast wherever you are listening. Now on to the interview. I'm so happy to be here today with Dr. Tom Babor. Welcome, Tom, and thank you for joining me today.
Good to be here.
For anyone who may not already know who you are, do you mind please just introducing yourself and telling me a little bit about yourself?
So by training professionally, I'm a social psychologist. I then went back to school and got an MPH in psychiatric epidemiology. I have been involved in addiction research at Harvard Medical School and then the University of Connecticut for over 50 years. I was the interim head of a psychiatry department for 4 years at UConn and then took over the Department of Community Medicine, which is the public health department, where I was chairman. And now I'm an emeritus professor at UConn, semi-retired. I'm still engaged in research and publishing and other things. And then I have edited books on alcohol, drug, and gambling policy.
You said that you're sort of semi-retired. Are you involved in any organizations these days outside of the research and the work that you continue to do?
Up until about 9 months ago, I was pretty much working half-time on international projects and doing work with WHO and writing articles and things like that. When the Trump administration began making major policy initiatives in the area of public health and scientific research, I became very concerned, and in collaboration with several other individuals, began an informal network, which is called the Addiction Science Defense Network. And we have been meeting twice a week. We have a coordinating committee. We issue policy statements, editorials, and engage in advocacy for the preservation of funding for key aspects of addiction research. So that has pretty much dominated my personal and professional life over the past 9 months.
So I know you through Addiction Science Publishing. Can you tell me a little bit about the work that you have done and continue to do in Addiction Science Publishing and on addiction journals?
I was a kind of a career scientist with a career award from NIAAA in the 1980s and continued to work on grants. But in the 1990s, I got a request from Griffith Edwards, a British psychiatrist who was the editor of the journal Addiction, and he wanted to make Addiction an international journal. Prior to that, it was the British Journal of Addiction. He changed the name to Addiction and established editorial offices in Australia and in the United States. And he asked me to be the regional editor for the journal Addiction. So I started that around 1992 and worked with Griffith until his retirement, and continued as the field editor, but stepped down somewhere around 2012 or so. Soon after that, I applied for and was accepted or hired as the editor of the Journal of Studies on Alcohol and Drugs, the oldest U.S. journal in the field. And I served as the editor of JSAD for 7 years. When I was working with Addiction, Griffith Edwards and I were involved in organizing the International Society of Addiction Journal Editors, starting with the meeting in Farmington, Connecticut in 1997. The society was formed in 2001, I think, and it's still going on today. Currently, I'm still a field editor for JSAD, and I still do work with editorial activities, particularly on sex and gender. I'm the co-author of a set of guidelines that have been adopted by most of the major journals around the world and promoted by WHO, the World Health Organization. It's called the SAGER guidelines, Sex and Gender Equity in Research. And we can talk a little bit about that.
So you spoke a bit about your activism with the Addiction Science Defense Network. You've been a journal editor, a researcher for many decades. From your perspective, what are some of the most pressing challenges or threats to addiction publishing and research in this moment?
The threats are significant. They affect the United States, people working in the areas of addiction research in the U.S., but they're also having repercussions internationally. What is going on is frightening. I've been in this field for over 50 years and have been recipients of just about every type of federal funding. And I can say that my career would not have gone in the direction it went in, where I dedicated pretty much my professional life to doing addiction research, had it not been for federal funding. And the funding cuts that are being implemented by the Trump administration are affecting the NIH, and that includes NIDA and NIAAA and offices that support gambling and tobacco research and other NIH institutes. They're affecting the data sets and the prevention programs that are maintained by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The budget cuts and directives and executive orders are going to be affecting harm reduction programs and treatment services throughout the country, block grants, reductions in funding for SAMHSA, and executive orders on things like diversity, equity, and inclusion, and on publishing scientific articles amount to censorship and language control, which is very serious for anybody engaged in any area of science. So this is a worst case scenario in terms of an authoritarian set of attitudes coming into a field which has been very productive and very valuable to public health. And the major threats to this country extend to the international sphere. The U.S. has withdrawn its membership from the World Health Organization, which has done excellent work in psychiatric epidemiology, substance abuse prevention, the promotion of evidence-based policies to drive down the rates of alcohol consumption. It's affected the programs, particularly HIV programs, throughout the world that have driven down the rates of HIV infection, particularly in developing countries. So research and public health practice throughout the world has been devastated in the addiction area because of precipitous U.S. budget cuts.
It's hard to divorce politics from federal funding for scientific research in any context.
Right.
It sounds like you agree with that, but do you see this political interference that we're witnessing now as being of a different type, not just a different degree maybe, but a different type of interference than what we might sort of expect?
Yeah, it's much, much different. And it takes many different forms. Funding is something that addiction researchers are dependent on. We have built an infrastructure which has driven the productivity of addiction science over the past 50 years. The research societies depend on federal funding, and we have expanded the reach of addiction research throughout the world, where other countries have begun to take an interest in the science that started in the 1970s in the U.S. So the journals that grew up over this period have helped to define us as a field. The collaboration that occurs internationally in HIV prevention, for example, the development of data sets that measure the epidemiology of addictive disorders, the World Health Organization's Global Burden of Disease study has put addiction really on the map in terms of the major area where health and longevity are affected. Changes in life expectancy can be documented now. Disability-adjusted life years can be measured. All of these things are being threatened currently by the precipitous changes in not only funding levels within the U.S. and internationally, but being affected by, and maybe it's not affected is the, not the world, infected is another word that's appropriate here. What's going on is our scientific research is being infected by anti-scientific attitudes, data sets that we relied on to track disease prevalence, overdose deaths, liver cirrhosis, alcohol-related cancer, smoking rates, adolescent health, and experimentation with alcohol and drugs. These data sets that have been relied on for 20 or 30 years are now being interfered with, taken down. The CDC's smoking and alcohol policy divisions have been terminated. All of these things are affecting the ability of addiction science to continue the important work that we've been doing over the past 20 or 30 years at the very least. And it's very concerning. So this is not just politics. This is a change in attitude. An authoritarian type of ideology that places political priorities above scientific truth. And when that begins to infect our ability to do science, then we've got a major problem.
Have you changed how you approach your work as an editor? You mentioned your field editor as a result of these policy changes.
Within the journal where I work, I haven't changed the way that I process manuscripts, but I have become more active in working with other scientists to develop a plan to push back against anti-scientific policies and attitudes and to preserve the funding levels, which in many cases constitute life or death types of decisions. What's going on internationally with the cut in support for HIV programs is actually leading to premature mortality for children in Africa who are infected with HIV. So there are things that we can be doing to mobilize the addiction science community to defend what we have developed, to not necessarily maintain it in exactly the same forms. Reform is always good, but you just don't tear things down without a plan. And we have not seen the plan other than ideological types of dictates coming from executive orders. An example is the issues around gender ideology and diversity. So grants that have been awarded by the federal government, undergone rigorous peer review, have been terminated merely because they used the word diversity. And the diversity often is extremely important for public health purposes because diverse populations have higher rates of substance use disorders, alcohol problems, and drug use. So we need to be able to monitor the subpopulations defined by sex and gender, for example. And we have guidelines which have been promoted internationally that encourage researchers and people publishing scientific articles in journals that encourage them to not only characterize their samples in terms of sex, but characterize their samples in terms of gender. And gender is different from sex. It's the roles that people adopt in a society that often are confused with sex, but have tremendous variability and tremendous influence on health. And women's roles in particular have been defined by societies in very, very different ways. And even in societies which consider themselves to be inclusive and equitable, the rates of research on women are not comparable to the inclusion of men in clinical trials, for example. So we don't have equity. And by monitoring these kinds of variables and defining them clearly, we're in a better position to improve health. But we can't respond to ideological dictates that forbid the use of terminology like gender. And this kind of censorship is antithetical to the scientific values that make good science possible.
You mentioned a couple times the guidelines, the SAGER guidelines that have been, from my perspective, widely embraced. Have you noticed any publishers or journals maybe distancing themselves from those guidelines in this time, or are you concerned about that?
At this point, I don't see the federal, U.S. federal government in the current administration going down to that level, except in cases where they've been writing to journal editors, particularly the editors of large biomedical journals, threatening them about the use of terminology. But for the smaller journals, the influence of this gender ideology has not entered into the ability of researchers to conduct their work, except in a few instances. There was an example recently of a directive coming from the federal government for federal employees who do research to take their names off publications that mentioned terms that were considered to be unacceptable, gender being one of them. And when that happened, the federal employees, if they had submitted a manuscript, were told to withdraw their names from the manuscript. I'm aware of one instance in the addiction field where that happened, and the editor allowed the author to withdraw the person's name from the list of co-authors and did it out of sympathy for the author so that and so the article could get published. But on the other hand, what we're talking about is compliance with a form of ghost authorship, where other guidelines say that if somebody contributes to an article, their name needs to be included so people know who was responsible for doing this. So we have ethical dilemmas that are emerging from the directives coming from the executive orders, in particular in the current administration.
Well, and to your point, it's maybe not necessary for there to be an explicit directive targeting guidelines like the SAGER guidelines. If researchers and authors, especially those early in their career, are aware that these priorities are being discouraged, to put it euphemistically, then they will sort of preemptively either steer themselves away from that research, right, or request to have their names taken off of manuscripts. And I've also heard of authors at least inquiring about that, for fear of having their name on a manuscript that might be focused on transgender health, for instance, and not wanting to be targeted by being an author on a manuscript like that. So it doesn't take explicit directives in this kind of environment. People know already what is expected of them in terms of compliance, which is, I think, even more insidious and scary in many ways. I would like to turn to the editorial published in the Nordic Studies on Alcohol and Drugs, signed by 29 addiction journal editors from 12 countries, issuing a clarion call to the addiction science community to reverse the unethical, illegal, and unscientific activities of the Trump administration. We've touched on this already, but if I'm not mistaken, you were one of the, if not the originator of this editorial, is that correct?
I helped to draft it, yes.
So, did you have any reservations about writing this editorial?
Well, it became apparent that what was going on at the beginning of the current administration was deeply troubling and was going to have an impact on addiction science. So we felt that, and we being the smaller group of people within the Addiction Science Defense Network, which includes a number of organizational representatives from the larger societies, as well as individuals, including, federal employees, people who've been fired, and addiction scientists in general. What we were seeing was deeply troubling, and the editorial actually spoke directly to the leadership of addiction societies, to individuals doing research, and to journal editors. And what we suggested is that the developments, which at the beginning of the administration were deeply troubling, the budget cuts, the suppression of data sets, the orders, executive orders, talking about terminology, the attack on science and diversity, all of these things were outlined in our editorial, which was published not only in the Nordic Journal, but in three other journals internationally. And what we said to the leadership of our field, including journal editors, is that people should be speaking out. They should be working to inform their constituencies about the problems that are imminent in the continued conduct of addiction research, and that we should be doing a better job of monitoring the situation as it evolves. And our network is engaged in basically information sharing and monitoring the changes that are being implemented through federal directors. With respect to what the journals should be doing, we felt that journal editors should be speaking out. The role of a journal editor is not just to process manuscripts, it's to exert leadership in a field. And people read the journals and pay attention to them. So if you look at the Journal of Addiction Medicine, a recent article talked about the first 100 days of the Trump administration and the impact it was having. And that article is informing our constituency about what the threats are to addiction science. I haven't seen articles like that in any other addiction journals. I don't know. I mean, we've seen editorials. We've asked journals to publish editorials, and most of what we're getting from addiction journals is either pushback or silence.
Do you have any advice for those addiction journal editors who have been silent, who maybe feel uncomfortable publicly advocating?
Well, they should just look and see what other areas of American and international science are doing. There are coalitions of journals, of journal editors, of societies. The American Psychological Association has been very vocal in speaking out and joining with other organizations on a case-by-case basis against the budget cuts, against the censorship, against the executive orders that are anti-scientific. All of these are examples of what people in our field could be doing. And at the very least, they should be engaged in sharing information. The Addiction Science Defense Network shares information among our coordinating committee, which consists of more than 30 people, including representatives of several major societies. But what we're not getting is the kind of information that could be useful in identifying illegal and unethical activities, which seem to be pervasive. So we have to wait until we see news articles and journalists going into detail. And that's kind of strange. in a field where you have some of the world's greatest scientists, not only neuroscientists and geneticists, but social scientists, survey researchers. Those skills could be applied to study what's going on, but people are just sitting back and watching.
I like that message, though, because there are people who may rightly be concerned about their livelihoods. They may not have tenure at their universities. So, if I'm hearing you right, you recommend people advocate publicly as much as they can. But I also like the idea that there are things you can do in terms of sharing information, even conducting research into the impacts.
Letters to your state and local representatives. ASDN, the Addiction Science Defense Network, has been drafting model letters. We sent out letters to all members of Congress, very reasonable, very rational, asking them to support addiction research and support the funding of addiction treatment and harm reduction programs. All of this is not controversial because Congress has the responsibility for appropriating funds. And the federal administration is, in numerous cases, cutting funding, which the courts have reversed because it appears to be constitutional. So we're not necessarily asking for political statements. We're asking for people just to point out to their state and local representatives the obvious things of what's going on and telling them that the imminent budget cuts that are in the proposed congressional budget now for next year are going to be devastating.
Have you had any responses? Do you know to your
Well,
letters?
when we issued our statement of concern, we had over 30 organizations sign on. Most of them consisted of treatment, prevention, and some research organizations. And they represented over 30,000 members in their membership files.
Wow.
So we were able to mobilize the field to make a statement that what is going on is harmful. And we sent that to all members of Congress. So it's possible to do things collectively. And it's much more evident outside our field, where the biomedical community and people do scientific research have been much more vocal in speaking out to Congress and to the public. We've also commissioned editorials. We've commissioned letters to the editor, op-ed editorials that have been published describing the benefits of addiction research. And these types of information are capable of getting out to the public and making people more aware of what's going on that's a threat to public health.
We've focused a lot on editors, on researchers. What do you think publishers can do to support addiction journal editors and journals?
Yeah, I think the publishers who control most of the addiction specialty journals have an obligation not only to be advising their journal editors individually, but by getting together and building a coalition that can stand up to the federal government. Most of these publishers are based outside of the US, so I'm not sure why they're so afraid. The silence has been deafening. There are lots of reasons not to speak out. There seems to be the norm of preemptive silence or a lack of interest, but what is evolving has the potential for being devastating to addiction science. We are in a position to lose the infrastructure as we know it, both in the US and to a lesser extent globally, that has been very valuable in monitoring and of providing solutions to addiction problems around the world. And if this continues, and we're in a critical period right now, it's now or never, because once these changes, budget cuts, are put into place, the field is going to be devastated. And if people don't speak up now, I think it's going to be too late after the administration implement its current plan to dismantle this scientific infrastructure for addiction, but also for public health in general.
It's hard to talk about being hopeful right now, but is there anything that keeps you hopeful, keeps you getting up in the morning?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that when pushback occurs in the media, when pushback occurs from the legal community, when pushback occurs by celebrities and entertainment industry, and certainly the work of our free press, which parallels the work of science, because science is a form of free press. We say what we want, and we have strict rules that tell our constituents to adhere to the truth. And if we can preserve that, we have a powerful weapon. It's the only defense against autocracy, and science should be playing a major role in promoting the defense of truth, honesty, integrity, and ethical values.
Well, it's hard to top that as a final message. Tom Babor, I'm so grateful to know you, and I'm very grateful for you giving me this time today. And just thank you so much for sharing your insights and your advocacy.
Thank you, Casey. It's great talking to you.
Behind the Evidence is supported by the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. It is intended for educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views expressed here are our own and do not necessarily reflect those of our employers or the authors of the articles we review. All patient information has been modified to protect their identities.